more and more of the veterans who signed on for duty in Iraq and Afghanistan are now signing up for classes on college campuses. For Navy vet Tracy Varekia, the GI Bill is helping pay for a nursing degree at Parkland College.
Sometimes I'll have people ask me, you know, how can I afford to go to school, or if I've got loans, and so that always, you know, it brings up that I'm a veteran because they do pay for my school.
Paying for school, though, is often just the first hurdle for veterans coming to campus. I'm Scott Cameron. The modern GI Bill and the challenges of making the transition from combat to classroom are schools and the military serving those who served in uniform, plus the historical context of the crisis in Ukraine. That's all coming up on Focus after this news. Good morning. I'm Scott Cameron. This is Focus from Illinois Public Media. Just over half of military veterans who used the GI Bill in recent years graduated. That's just slightly lower than the roughly 60% rate for the general population. That's all according to a new report released last week based in part on data from the Veterans Administration. It is the first study ever done on that issue. It also shows that many veterans take more time to finish their degree than other students, a fact that's not particularly surprising when you consider the challenges many veterans often face when they return for military service. Many colleges and universities have launched programs in recent years to make that transition a bit easier. The military offers support as well. We'll talk about those in just a few minutes. If you are a recent veteran who's enrolled in college after the military, tell us your story. The number is 800-222-9455. Again, 800-222-9455. There's also a conversation on Twitter at Focus580. Later in the hour, history repeats itself, this time in Ukraine. We'll get a reading list on the crisis in Crimea, but first, the GI Bill and the transition from combat to classroom. Johnny Watts served in signals intelligence in the U.S. Army in Iraq. He graduates next month from the University of Illinois and joined me in the studio. Johnny, you're about to graduate with a degree in electrical engineering. How did you know that's what you wanted to do?
Actually, I didn't. My boss, my platoon leader, when I was in the Army, he was a graduate from West Point in aerospace engineering. And so we'd often have talks about his experiences in engineering and things he got to learn. And so I was really interested in that, but I wasn't necessarily interested in aerospace. Mm-hmm. With my job, we got to deal with a lot of high-tech equipment, a lot of electronics. And there were a lot of things I saw. I was like, oh, we could do this and make it better. Mm-hmm. And so I was like, well, they have a really great electrical engineering program. So I got here, thought I wanted to do communications, took a class, hated it. and so I took a series of classes and I finally found something that I really liked, you know, in the sophomore year. So
you said that you knew that they had a pretty good engineering program here.
Yes.
Did you know you wanted to come here specifically?
I knew I wanted to come in Illinois. I really wanted to come to this school because of the caliber of the engineering program. But I applied to SIUE and SIUC as well.
Okay, Southern.
Southern Illinois. I'm from around SIUE, so I really didn't want to go there, but I need to apply.
Get away a little bit.
Yeah, just a little bit away.
A
phone call away at least.
Yeah. When did you apply?
I applied while I was in Iraq in 2008.
Okay, yeah. But you were still in the country. You were still in Iraq serving at the time, and were looking ahead at that point already to say, hey.
Right.
Do you think that you would have been able to get this degree if you hadn't served in the military first?
I think for me personally, coming from a very small school that didn't have very high hopes for a lot of their students, I don't think I would have been very successful coming right out of high school to a school like this.
And it sounds like even the idea to study, I mean, you talked to your commanding officer saying, you know, what his experience was.
Yeah, so it wasn't really anything I probably even would have thought about. Most of the instructors and guidance that we got at my school didn't really talk much about schools outside of the local community college. Mm-hmm. The biggest school that we ever heard about was SIUE, and that's because it was just down the street.
Yeah.
But they didn't really talk much about things. I didn't even know what engineering was.
Being in the military really kind of opened that door.
Yeah, absolutely.
Is that why you went in the military?
No, I went into the military because I really didn't know what I wanted to do, but I know I didn't want to be home doing nothing. So, my parents, my dad was in the Air Force, sister's in the Air Force, got uncles and stuff. I was like, think I want to kind of get some experience and kind of, you know, learn some things while I try to figure out where I want to go and what I want to do.
So coming out of the military then, I've heard that the military offers a transition course for returning vets. One person described it to us as death by PowerPoint. I don't know if you agree with that.
I do agree.
How did the Army prepare you for the transition back to campus?
I don't really think they did.
What was missing?
Actually, I don't even remember anything they talked about. It's probably because I didn't pay much attention. It was mostly just a checkbox to get, you know, done with the process. Mm-hmm. There was the things I did find useful. They did talk a lot about the GI Bill benefits, so I had quite a bit of information on that.
So you knew what you had available.
I knew a lot of stuff I had available, but as far as trying to help us identify like what the type of differences we're going to see when we get out of the military, I don't remember them talking much about it. And
would you have hoped to see that? I mean, would that something that would have helped you?
As a vet, I don't know if I would have paid much attention to that either, because it's one of those you have to see it to believe it. You know, they might have told us, and then when we saw it, we probably would have been a little less surprised, but not much.
So hindsight maybe is a, right. It could have been useful, but at the time, if only you knew then what you know now.
Right. So, you know, it would have only been useful after we saw it. So necessarily, I don't know if it would have been necessarily useful.
At the time. Okay. I'm thinking about when students get to college, they often try to find other people like themselves, people they can relate to. As you moved from an Army post to a college campus, was that something you were thinking about?
It wasn't anything that I made an effort to think about. It wasn't that I just thought, all right, I have to find people like me. I've never really been a go find people to hang out with type of person. Mm-hmm. I came here with my wife, and so she was my person to hang out with, and her and the dog. but I did find that once I got here, it was difficult to find people that I really wanted to be around. Hmm. When I first got here, I got involved with a couple of the engineering groups. Really great people. They really helped me get back into the rhythm of school. But I didn't really get too involved with them, mainly because there was such a big difference between the way I thought, the way my experiences, the things I had talked about, and what they all were interested in, talked about, and did.
So, I mean, I'm picturing you're sitting in class, you're working with other students, you're often in small groups and whatnot, and many of them, I would imagine, fresh out of high school. Was it sort of an issue of just finding things to talk about, sort of finding things to just, I mean, you're right, you're coming from a very different experience. You're coming back having served in the military for a number of years, you're here with your wife. What was that barrier, I guess, between you and them?
I think the biggest barrier was not them not knowing anything about the military, the lifestyle or the people or the branches or anything really. I've met very few that actually knew that there were veterans here on campus. Okay. They thought of this as, you know, they found out I was older than, you know, 18, 19, maybe even 20. They were like, whoa, what are you doing here?
Well, that makes you feel good.
Yes. Yeah. So it's like, well, you know, I'm not a traditional student. And, a lot of times I spend a lot of time explaining to them, I'm married. It's like, oh, what? It's like, do you have kids? Like, no, I don't know if I could really handle kids at this moment.
Yeah.
I'm trying to handle calculus, so. but I didn't remember what it was like to be 18 and not really have any experiences outside of your home. And I think after being here and seeing their barrier between me and, you know, them in the military, like they don't know anything about that lifestyle, it made me think back a little bit about, all right, when I was 18, I didn't know anything about it either.
Right.
And I knew kind of what my dad taught me, and that was about it. So
yeah, I can kind of hear it got a little tiring, I think, if I'm reading between the lines, trying to keep answering some of these questions. At the same time, did you sort of see like it was your, I don't know if responsibility is the right word, but you know, that you wanted to try to help them to understand them? But were you open about your experience and wanting to talk about that, or was that a hard thing to do?
For me, I was very open. I know some vets have had much more traumatic experience than I have, but for the most part, if it wasn't, the one question everybody likes to avoid is, have you ever shot anybody? So, well, I don't want to talk about that. I do, however, would love to tell you about my good experiences, the bad experiences, the people I met, things I liked, things I really didn't like. A lot of times people say, you know, well, how did you do it when you were 18? I was like, well, I really believe that almost anybody can do it. I think anybody can do it. It's just a mental thing. All right, can you tell yourself you have to? Because a lot of people say, oh, man, I can never do that. I can never run 6 miles, or I could never ruck march for 12 miles with, you know, a lot of weight on your back. And it's like, well, yeah, you could. You just probably don't want to.
Did it ever come up in class? I mean, service and people, I mean, did you ever even feel maybe put on the spot at some points with, you know, talking about a history class or something going on? And
I was typically very open with, you know, if we ever did introductions, that was one of the things I said. It was mainly just to kind of get that out so that when, you know, a couple weeks in, I like, you know, so it didn't come up and sound weird. And it was like, oh, well, so yeah, I don't really mind. I let people know, because if they have, I've had people come up and ask questions. Mm-hmm. Either they were thinking about joining, or they had family or friends who were asking about it and they didn't know anyone. I was like, well, sure, I'd love to talk to them and give them my perspective.
You know, did you feel like you had an advantage over the younger students? I mean, with coming with more experience, a little more mature, that type of thing, academically?
When I first got here, no, absolutely not.
Why do you say that?
Well, I hadn't done anything academic-related, school-related, for 6 years. So the last thing I touched was high school pre-calculus in 2003. 2009, I'm jumping in and I'm trying to relearn all of that stuff. So for my first semester here, I really didn't feel like I had any advantage at all. But when I got to the second semester, I started to realize that after I got my grades from my first semester, it was really great. I kind of felt that I did have a bit of an advantage, and it was only in the sense that I knew what it was like to be out and do things that you didn't really want to do all the time. Mm-hmm. So play didn't really, you know, I could get all my work done. I had the determination, even when it felt like, oh, this is not going to work. I was like, all right, just keep at it, keep moving. And I think that's really where my, I don't want to call it advantage, but yeah, I think that's where my advantage came from.
And was there, I mean, you sort of described, so it was hard at the beginning and then things got a little bit easier. Was there anything that, I don't know, was there a moment or was there anything that you could point to that helped make that transition? Something, finding some of those friends, something that the college had or the university offered that helped turn that corner a little bit?
So there's a couple things. Academically, I had the moral engineering program.
Moral engineering?
Yeah.
What is that?
It's a program in the College of Engineering, and they deal with underrepresented students. Hmm. And so when I first got here, Dean Ivan Filavila, I owe him a lot. He really, really did help me to kind of get my feet under me when I was here. At that first semester, you know, I got a C on my first exam. And coming up in high school, everything was really easy. Didn't really have to study. Mm-hmm. A's all the way through. And if I got a B, it was because I knew I didn't actually study and I just showed up and was like, well, let's see how this goes. Yeah. I put a lot of time into all my classes and I got like a C on my first exam. I had like a C plus and another one. And these were my first exams. And I was like, did I make a mistake by coming here?
Can I do this kind of a...
Right. And so I talked to him every now and then, and he really helped me to kind of calm down and just look at it again. And the professors were amazing as well. But academically, it was the moral engineering program. A lot of the students that were in Nesby and SHIP, there are a couple engineering organizations, I studied with them and kind of traded answers and talked with them a lot. So
just finding some of those networks, it sounded like, finding the people who could contribute. There are, the dean, is that part of a specific program? Is that the moral engineering program that sort of helps? Is that just for veterans or is that for?
No, it's actually for underrepresented. So Hispanics, blacks, I guess like anybody who, and that's who they cater to, but they allow allow anybody to come and, you know, join their groups and study with people. And
then forming, you know, finding those groups to be a part of, those networks to support you. It sounds like that made a big difference.
Yeah.
What's next for you?
For me?
Yeah.
I'm headed to San Diego. I'm going to be working with Qualcomm.
Congratulations.
Thank you. I'll be out there working as a hardware engineer. Really looking forward to that.
When do you move?
We leave the end of May, so
because like a week after graduation.
My wife, she's from Northern California, and so, you know, she came here with me and stuck it out with me, and she doesn't like the fact that there's no trees and stuff, so we're going to go take her to the beach or something.
And
like
the 3 feet of snow that we got this winter
hasn't
helped that anyway. Well, good luck.
Thank you.
Iraq War veteran and soon-to-be Illinois graduate Johnny Watts. He currently serves as president of Illini Veterans here on campus. I talked with him yesterday here in our studios. If you're a recent veteran and you made the transition from combat to campus, give us a call. Tell us your story. 800-222-9455 is our number. You can also drop us an email, will-talk@illinois.edu, or tweet us at Focus580. Nicholas Osborne is Assistant Dean of Student Services and Director of the Veterans Programs at the University of Illinois Urbana campus. He joins us now by phone from his office here. Nick, welcome to Focus.
Oh, thank you.
That's good to talk to you. Johnny Watts, we just heard there, you know, he talked about when he first got to campus, he struggled a little bit academically, sort of finding his way here. Now, of course, he's heading off to California. He's got it sounds like a great job with a high-tech company out there. At the beginning of the show, we referenced the report from the Student Veterans of America. It shows that he had essentially, roughly, a little better than a 50-50 chance of graduating. What kinds of things, what kinds of support make the difference for veterans like him when they get to campus here?
It's a great question, and it's a question that colleges and universities across the country and at conferences were all putting out on the table. And I think one of the most important things is coming into a welcoming community for all students, but particularly for veterans who have had a break being out of high school for a while, and then coming in and oftentimes having a sense of intimidation. I haven't taken a math class in years. I haven't written a paper in years. That break of education can also manifest a lack of confidence. And so I think that coming in and knowing that there is a central office available to them as well as peers that they can relate to, and as Johnny touched on, being non-traditional and having these very unique experiences, that community piece is so fundamental.
And it sounded like, I mean, you could hear it when he was talking, it made a big difference once he identified that peer group, once he figured out and gained that confidence again, it made all the difference.
Absolutely. And the bonds in the military are so strong that many students in my own military journey, as well as that when you leave the military, you do feel that dip, that you are leaving behind a pseudo family or a brotherhood or a sisterhood. And we want to replicate that as much as possible for incoming veterans.
So what are the things are you working on here on campus to help ease that transition?
So we have a very strong relationship with the student veterans group, the Illini Veterans, and I make contact with all incoming veterans prior to their physical arrival on campus. And usually I'll meet with them for coffee to find out more about their personal story, as well as any sort of support resources we can put in place before the rush of classes start. We have a mentoring program where we'll match an incoming veteran up with a student veteran who's been on campus for a while. It's very similar to a sponsor program in the military.
Mm-hmm.
And we have just different events, orientations specifically for veterans and things like that throughout the semester.
Hmm. When you first meet with students, so you meet with them actually before, with student veterans, before they even get here on campus. I mean, what are you telling them? What kind of things are you looking for?
I typically, and this is the tricky part, but I typically want to find out what their fears and anxieties are coming in. And that's an interesting piece of military culture because the military, for many of us, teaches us from day one that you don't talk about your problems, you don't burden people, you're part of a team. So to get them to sort of comfortably, what I call remove their social armor and say, you know what, I'm feeling some anxiety about math, or I'm not really feeling like I jive with some of the civilian students here because I'm older, or I have these different unique experiences, or like Johnny said, I'm married and I'm managing a family as well. So getting a sense of what they're coming in with and then reassuring them and also reiterating the different services we have on campus as well as within the community.
And just starting to shift that culture a little bit too. It makes me think there was a report a few years back that you've written about. It showed that more schools are working to help veterans make the transition to college, but it also showed that many aren't doing enough to train faculty and staff about the experience, about the culture. Johnny talked about that a little bit. I mean, how does that play out on a campus?
I think it's a great question. And, you know, generally speaking, what I've found and what my research has shown is that veterans oftentimes will come in with an assumption that the university is, I use quotes here, progressive and liberal and therefore anti-military. And then we have faculty and staff who oftentimes have not served in the military, so they're removed from that culture. And they have a different set of assumptions. And what I find is that we have these different groups on campus who are all sort of contending with their own assumptions. And really what my job is to educate and provide tools for both groups so we can see the complexity and hopefully facilitate a deeper dialogue that's going to give us all newfound understanding.
And we know that, you know, I think it's less than 1% of the U.S. population has served in combat in recent decades. So how do you do that?
That's an excellent point. I have a very robust faculty and staff training program that I do, and I also speak at national conferences and state conferences. And oftentimes I'll just provide some very basic context about who veterans are, why we're hearing about them in higher ed. And then, you know, as Johnny touched on, there's certain questions that faculty and staff need to be mindful of, you know, not asking, have you ever shot anybody? Have you ever had a traumatic experience? So giving them some tangible tools, and also anything that we can do to promote visibility on campus. So we oftentimes will invite faculty and staff to an event if we're having a veterans discussion panel, or at a football game we'll bring all of our student veterans out on the field to be recognized. And I think that by weaving this thread of visibility, it helps break down some of these assumptions.
You've mentioned that you do training sessions with faculty members and staff and other people on campus. And you start those training sessions with a question, how do I view veterans? What do you learn from those responses as people answer that question?
For many, many folks, the veterans are oftentimes a family member, and it's usually a distant family member. World War II veterans come up a lot, so you're typically looking at white males who served in World War II. And then I'll ask them, what emotions come up when you think about veterans? And that dialogue will oftentimes lead to post-traumatic stress or trauma or things of that nature. And then the last question I'll ask is, where do you get your information? Is this, you know, a personal experience, or is this something you're getting exclusively from the media? And I try to start that by all of us having sort of a general mindfulness of how we're getting this information, and then if that information is indeed supported by data.
Do you find that attitudes start to shift pretty quickly as people talk about this and think? I mean, because a lot of times you figure motivations are probably pretty good. Maybe it's a curiosity. Maybe there is a certain novelty to things. They don't have that kind of experience. I don't think many people are trying to be trying to hurt people or in some way offend people. So what do you find is experience once you start to have those discussions?
I think that's right on the money, is that what comes out is that it's oftentimes, you know, Nick, we really want to help out. We don't really know this population, or we don't really know how to start, or what can we do? But I have found that at the university here and at the conferences I've presented at, that folks are just so passionate and kind about what can we do to get involved. And when I oftentimes will share reports that some of our students feel a little bit of tension about the perception of climate, I can see that the faculty and staff take that very seriously. And so they're very curious about what they can do to help offset and deconstruct that assumption.
What you've mentioned that you were a veteran yourself and came back to campus. What was that experience like?
I had a unique experience in that I enlisted in the military with a master's degree. I ended up becoming an officer, and then when I came back from a year-long deployment, I used the GI Bill to finish my doctoral program at UC Davis. And so I felt like I was a little bit ahead of the game and that I was familiar with how to navigate through higher ed. And I also had a strong support system in place when I came home and left the military. And I think that those are what gave me an advantage. But for many service members I work with, the TAP class that we, you know, the Death by PowerPoint that we reference, it's a lot of information in a very quick period of time. And for many veterans, they've shared with me that they didn't initially see themselves as college students in high school. So it makes the process and it makes the culture of higher ed even that much more challenging to navigate.
You know, one of the ideas, I think about what you just said there, behind the GI Bill is that members of the military are in some ways working to pay for their education while they're in the service. And looking at the results of this survey that came out last week, if nearly one in two vets don't graduate, even though that's just a little bit lower than non-military students. Is the military and our colleges doing enough, do you think, to serve those who've served?
That's a million-dollar question. I think that we all need to be doing more. And I think part of that is that, and the military is aware of this, that their transition assistance program is oftentimes more vocationally based.
Yeah, Johnny said a similar thing, yeah.
Yeah, and or it's based on a certain type of school, such as an online learning environment or a for-profit, and not necessarily a brick-and-mortar. So I think that there needs to be more training there. And I think from a university standpoint, it's all across the board. I think some universities are doing a great job, and some universities are just sort of starting out on this trajectory with this population.
Yeah. We're talking about the GI Bill and recent efforts on campuses here and elsewhere to ease the transition for veterans coming back from combat. Nick Osborne is with us. He's director of Veterans Programs at the U of I. Let me now bring in Ed Humes into the conversation. He wrote the book, Over Here, How the GI Bill Transformed the American Dream, and he joins us now by phone from California. Ed, thanks for talking with us.
Of course. Happy to.
Now, we're talking about the GI Bill. I mean, the first thing that's important to note here is that there really is no single GI Bill at this point. When was the first GI Bill of Rights implemented, and what did it do for veterans?
Well, it was the World War II GI Bill. The Servicemen's Readjustment Act was its official name, and the idea was to help veterans return to peacetime and reenter the workforce. But the difference then compared to now was that we had 16 million men and women who served during World War II. That's one in eight Americans alive at the time. So there was a massive concern, what's going to happen when all these guys return and need jobs and want to start families and need a place to live?
Mm-hmm.
How do we handle that? It was never done before on that massive a scale. So the idea was to provide housing and education and other benefits that would help with that transition and avoid the turmoil that happened after World War One.
After, yeah, with some of the issues in the, what was it called, the riot in D.C. That came over, some of the veterans were actually pushed off while they were trying to argue for more funding and things. If that was the goal of the bill, did it succeed?
Wildly, beyond any expectations. It was one of the most transformative acts of government in the history of the world, really. I mean, its effects were so far-reaching that it literally created the middle class. That was the stimulus, the ultimate stimulus program that took a nation of renters, which most of us Americans were before World War II, and jump-started home ownership. It made it possible for guys to come home and buy a house for $64 a month and no money down. Mm. It was cheaper than renting a place. That's where suburbia came from. And when you look at the impact on education, so funny, I was just looking back over some comments that the very progressive president of the University of Chicago made at the time just before the war ended. He was a very progressive educator, Robert Hutchins, but he predicted that the GI Bill would turn colleges into hobo jungles, his word, because the men and women, but mostly men, because it was World War II, were not full of this college material. Colleges were for the elite, primarily for the wealthy. And now you got these guys, just like today. College was not on the radar for the veterans of World War II before the war, and suddenly you had millions entering college. And the fear was that standards would be lowered and the educational experience would be ruined, and American colleges would be ruined, and just the opposite happened. They performed incredibly well, and 14 Nobel Prize winners came out of that group of veterans who came home from the war, and I interviewed a few of them. They said they were never going to go to college. One of them was running the Fermi Lab, redefining physics, inventing cures for cancer. The payback from that investment in educating these veterans changed everything, and it also changed our thinking about who should go to college. But what they had, and it was fascinating listening to Johnny before, what the World War II veterans had was numbers. They were not alone. These campuses were constructing whole cities to accommodate veterans and their families and giving them stipends to live there. The government provided, the GI Bill provided living expenses too.
Yeah.
And they had one another to rely on. And even though it was fearful for them to enter college, which they had never imagined doing, they had support built in just because
there were so many of them.
Pretty substantial number of people for you.
That's some pretty profound things that you just said, that this effectively created the modern middle class by opening these doors. It completely changed perceptions about education and access to education. And yet there were those attitudes at the time. And was that a common attitude? Was this bill widely embraced, and were the benefits widely embraced at the time?
No one expected, least of all the congressmen who adopted this bill, and not even FDR envisioned what would happen. He shepherded it through, and they actually passed this bill before the war ended. They wanted to be prepared. They thought that the provision of the bill that would be most used and was most controversial was called the 5220 provision. And this was a program that gave returning veterans unemployment payments of $20 a week for a year. That's 52 weeks, 20 bucks. And everybody worried that the veterans would just go on the dole and not get back and reenter society with this.
And boy, they couldn't be more wrong, huh? Yeah.
Well, most veterans didn't even take advantage of it, or only did it for a portion of their eligibility to receive it. And what turned out to be the two biggest programs, the college program, 2.2 million veterans went to four-year colleges, and then another 5 million went to vocational schools off the GI Bill. At best, the congressman who wrote this legislation predicted a few hundred thousand would take advantage of the educational benefits.
Okay.
They were so wrong about what these veterans would want to do.
Yeah, on so many levels, it sounds like. Thinking now, coming a little bit further down the road, you've got a whole book on this issue, essentially, but, in 90 seconds or so here, how has that bill then evolved over time to what we have now, the post-9/11 GI Bill?
Well, it was never as generous as it was after World War II. And the Greatest Generation was also, in that sense, the most privileged generation, because they got a free ride to any college that would accept them. Period. University of Illinois, Harvard, the Sorbonne, wherever they went to them all. And now, until fairly recently, the benefits had gotten pretty miserly. That it wouldn't even cover a state university. 4 years. It's gotten a little better in the last couple of years because of the realization that we were really shortchanging today's veterans compared to the past. But it's still not as generous a program as it was back then.
Hmm. And there is now a push to include things like offering in-state tuition levels to returning veterans and things like that. Well, Ed Humes, thank you very much for your time. Ed Humes wrote the book Over Here, How the GI Bill Transformed the American Dream, and he joined us by phone from California. Thank you very much.
My pleasure.
And we are still talking with Nicholas Osborne. Nick Osborne, Assistant Dean of Students, Student Services, and Director of Veterans Programs at the University of Illinois. And Nick, David called in from Urbana just a moment ago. He couldn't hang on, but he's wondering, do we need an extension to the GI Bill? He says that might make it easier for more people to go to college. What do you think?
I do. I think that it would provide, on a long-term basis, I think that it's a great idea.
Now, I've been watching, even while we're sitting here, some of the headlines going on and things. We've been talking a lot about perceptions of veterans on campus and easing the transition into campus. And I wonder, as I watch headlines and things going on in Fort Hood right now, people are jumping to a lot of conclusions with very, very little information at this point. And I hadn't always connected it back to actual folks on the ground walking by me here down the street and how they are viewing this and how that affects perceptions of them here on campus.
Mm.
When you hear words like Iraq War veteran and mental health and shooting, how do events like this factor into what you're working on in your discussions and training?
I really appreciate you asking that question. Interestingly enough, I actually fielded a few emails and phone calls yesterday, which is fairly common when that happens. And this is something that, going back to perceptions and research I've conducted, that many veterans feel that there is sort of a blanketed assumption when they say that they served in Iraq or Afghanistan, that the natural response is, oh, then there must be something wrong with you. You must be maladjusted or possibly dangerous. And obviously what happened at Fort Hood was a tragedy. And I think that post-traumatic stress statistics and traumatic brain injury, these are very real things. I would never want to minimize that. I think that the other side of that coin, though, is we don't want to exclusively look at veterans through a lens of trauma. And that's something I emphasize at the faculty and staff training is absolutely these things are out there, but this isn't the full story. And we have to look at the complexity of this. And particularly with any group on student, you would never want to apply any sort of blanketed assumption and essentially ostracize that group.
Does, well, it reminds me, you know, there really is no single veteran experience. You know, I talked with one woman who had served in the Navy for a number of years at the time, and she's, you know, now entering the nursing program over at Parkland. You know, and people think, oh, wait, they find out she was in the Navy and worked particularly in some construction works, and she described herself as sort of this, you know, small woman, a mother of several children now, and they look at her like in shock, just disbelief. I mean, if it's also a reminder that there is no single type of veteran. These are the same range of people, just like you and me, that you're going to see anywhere else.
Absolutely. And this veteran's identity may be also a part of a larger identity, you know, whether it's based on sexual orientation or religious affiliation or race and ethnicity, that this is a piece of who they are. And, you know, it's somewhat what's sort of fun when I do the faculty and staff training, they'll say, well, what does a veteran look like? And we'll say, well, you know, broad-shouldered and high and tight haircut or this or that. So I do think that there is sort of an image of what a veteran is and the identity that goes with that. But we have to look at it through that larger holistic lens that you've just touched on.
And do you, I know you've done surveys and you've just really begun this process in many ways, but do you have a sense yet of what works to address some of those issues and change some of those perceptions and make campuses a friendlier place?
I believe that the visibility is so important, and we've had great support in this community with local newspapers running articles and interviews with our students where they can tell their stories. We've done a dozen student-veteran discussion panels. I just partnered with Uni High School last year with the Veterans Oral History Project, and I think that any type of venue where we have students sharing their personal narratives and we can open it up for questions and answers, that it helps remove some of the mystery. And then hopefully by removing the mystery, we're also removing some of the inaccurate assumptions that we're making.
And what about on the flip side then, for the veterans themselves? I mean, though, you know, some places focus primarily on online classes. There are veteran centers in many places, vets-only classes, vet orientations when they first come to campus. What types of things do you think are worth focusing on going forward for those people?
I think that we need a central office that advocates for veterans. And when you say, well, what does it mean to advocate? I think that it's everything from helping them with their initial transition to educating the faculty and staff to working with veterans in the larger community. I think those town and gown relationships with the different veterans organizations are so important. And really listening to what the students have to say. I spend a lot of time with my students. We have a veterans lounge, which is just a phenomenal resource that I highly encourage. It gives them a place to go. Particularly because veterans commute to campus, it gives them a constant space that's theirs. And I think that the listening component is so important because, you know, I say this tongue-in-cheek, veterans are a vocal group, and they don't have any problems saying, hey, you know, this isn't cool or we need this. Mm-hmm. And I really appreciate those types of authentic conversations that take place with them.
Now, do you think you're a one-person staff from what I understand, you know, and you've got a lot to do with, you know, especially as we see more and more veterans returning who have returned, who are now looking to take advantage of the benefits under the GI Bill, come to campus either as undergrad or grad students, and we know that most of them are undergrad students at this point. Are you satisfied, I guess, that what you're talking about is happening here and that you have what you need to change this?
I have a group of a half a dozen student veterans, and Johnny's actually one of them. And, you know, they're such a capable group that if I give them a task or if we come up with an idea, They just recently put together this 5K, which will be taking place tomorrow. They did it last year for the first time. They raised over $10,000 to benefit the Chez Family Foundation Center for Wounded Veterans and Higher Education.
Mm-hmm.
So they're an extremely talented group. And right now it works. Right now I think that where we were when I started 3.5 years ago, we've definitely made solid ground. But I don't think there is ever an end point. I think that this program will continue to evolve. As we eventually open the Center for Wounded Veterans in the fall of 2015, I think that we're going to see more and more resources and more leadership coming out of the University of Illinois. And at that point, we're going to also need the conversation about staffing. And so I feel right now we're fine, but I see ahead that we are going to have that larger dialogue about the best way to staff and expand.
Yeah, to meet that growing need.
Yeah.
Nick Osborne is Assistant Dean of Student Services. He directs the Veterans Programs at the University of Illinois Urbana campus. Joined us here by phone from his office. Nick, thank you very much. It was nice to talk to you.
My pleasure. You have a great day.
Thanks. You too, and good luck. Up next, the books to check out if you want the long view, the historical view on Putin's latest pursuits in Ukraine. We'll get a reading list on the crisis in Crimea. Stay with us. It's Focus from Illinois Public Media. This is Focus from Illinois Public Media. I'm Scott Cameron. Since February, mid-February or so, we've heard a consistent flow of news out of Ukraine as Russia exerted more and more control over parts of Ukraine. Yes, it's a cliche, but history repeats itself. The Soviet Union's gone, but this is just the latest power struggle between Moscow and the West, with an Eastern European country stuck right in the middle. We asked Catherine Stoner to put together a reading list of books that trace some of the relevant history of this standoff. She's a political scientist and senior fellow at the Spoglies Institute for International Studies at Stanford. She joins us now by phone from California. Catherine, welcome to Focus.
Thanks very much for having me.
Now, when Russian President Vladimir Putin announced what he called the reunification with Crimea, as he put it, he said that, quote, to understand the reason behind such a choice, it is enough, he said, to know the history of Crimea and what Russia and Crimea have always meant for each other. No matter which side of this someone happens to be on, there's no question there's a lot of history underlying this latest split over Ukraine.
Yes, absolutely. And it isn't just President Putin who has this strong historical sensitivity about Crimea. It's a lot of Russians actually have this feeling. And Crimea and what is now modern Ukraine were parts of the Russian Empire. Even before the Soviet period and the Bolshevik Revolution in 1917. And so it's Russia's opening to the West. It's its only warm water port. And there are also strong, as we know now in particular, ethnic ties between Russians living there and Russians in the homeland.
And that was part of the reason for, I don't know if justification is the right word, but he said they were many what he considered Russian citizens, so they quickly put out passports. We've seen this before, and then said, "Okay, we have to go. We have to go in to protect our own citizens."
Right.
Well, we have you have very kindly put together a list of four books here that offer a little bit of that context, a little bit of that history, and also some interesting perspectives. You know, from particularly that Russian perspective. Why don't we just start? The first one here that I see, Angela Stent, "The Limits of Partnership." What do we learn from that book?
Sure. So this is a new book by a longtime observer of Russian politics and analyst of U.S.-Russian relations. So she's written a number of books on U.S.-Russian relations as a frequent visitor to Russia and lives in Washington. She's a political scientist at Georgetown, but she's also served in two different administrations in the foreign policy establishment here in the United States. And it's a book that looks at some of the themes that President Putin himself raised in the speech he gave about 2 weeks ago, talking about the historical connection and also all of the wrongs he feels that that the United States in particular has perpetrated upon Russia since the end of the Cold War. Really dancing in the end zone is what he's upset about, that we have not actually been a good partner.
And he really views the Cold War and the collapse of the Soviet Union as a great tragedy.
Yeah, he means that in the sense of, that's the sort of infamous quote, but he means that in the sense of the way it happened and the way these zones of Russia's natural interest basically just fell away from Russia. So he doesn't really mean that he wants to reestablish the Soviet Union per se. That said, he wants to reestablish Russia as a great power, and so that's one of the themes that Stint and actually all four of these books hit, and I think bring to the fore nicely. One of the things Stint does too is to take us through basically the collapse of the Soviet Union and the relations between U.S. and Russia in the 1990s, which were warm, and then begin to cool off really after about 1999, and then get very cool after about 2003 or so.
Yeah, with some of the other things going on in the world and other countries and disagreement over everything from NATO involvement throughout Eastern Europe to the expansion of NATO in some cases,
right,
and then things going on in the Middle East.
Exactly.
And I should say, too, that the list of these books and descriptions of them and what you can learn from them, it's all at our website. So this is Angela Stint, The Limits of Partnership. The full list is at will.illinois.edu. And you mentioned sort of the differences between the views of how the West views Russia and how Russia views itself. The next book on the list here is actually written by a Russian author, Dmitry Trenin, called Post-Imperium. What does that book tell us?
So Dmitry is a former Soviet Defense Ministry official, and one of the interesting things about this book, I find, is that he weaves in his biography with the collapse of the Soviet Union and then the aftermath in Russia's relations with Europe and then the United States. He's pretty politically progressive, so this is not somebody who would necessarily be giving Mr. Putin's perspective on things. So although it is a Russian perspective, it is not the perspective of the Russian government. Dmitry now works for the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace in Moscow, and he's worked there for a number of years, and he talks about that as well. But one of the interesting things is that he has been in the Russian defense and foreign policy establishment. He knows the players. And so like Stint, he's drawing on interviews and personal experiences to talk about Russia and what Russia's interests are. So I think he also gives us some nice insight into some of Russia's internal problems. So even though Mr. Putin has this aspiration of reestablishing Russia as a great power and lists all of his grievances to us since the end of the Soviet Union in his speech that he gave 2 weeks ago, Trenin points out that Russia's not a great power. And actually, Stint points this out as well. It's an aspiring power. It's a regional power, as President Obama said. But it has, as Trenin notes for us, tremendous demographic problems. It has tremendous economic problems. You know, that is not the basis on which you can become a great power.
Hmm. There are two more, and I'm not sure we're going to have time for both. So let me say that there's one here called Andrei Sigonkoff. I'll maybe mispronounce that. It's Sigonkoff. This is a young Russian here in the U.S., a book called Russian Foreign Policy. More information on that on our website, again, will.illinois.edu. But let me finish up here with Jeffrey Mankoff, Russian Foreign Policy, The Return of Great Power Politics. Tell me about that one.
So, yeah, this is a really interesting book written in about late 2011, 2012. And it's really a long essay. I would say it's a relatively easy, straightforward read. But, again, it takes us through the various grievances that Mr. Putin brought up 2 weeks ago, except Jeff Mankoff brings them up 2 years ago. And there's something that I've had screamed across tables in Moscow at me by foreign policy officials, everything we've done wrong, from NATO bombing of Serbia in the late 1990s, which the Russia views as a Slavic brotherly nation, the attempt to install an anti-ballistic missile system in Poland and the Czech Republic, NATO bombing Libya and exceeding the UN mandate in Russia's opinion that it was given for intervening in Libya, and then Russia's suspicions of the United States in particular intervening in the first Ukrainian Orange Revolution in 2004 and in Georgia the year before that. So it's a quicker read, I would say, than the Stint book, but it has, I think, nice details about some of those earlier conflicts and incursions and complaints that Russia has against the West.
So all of these, tying back, and you've listed a number of events there that have really shaped what we're seeing now, both in terms of Russia's ambitions there in the region, as well as the interactions that we're seeing. And, you know, I keep using the word standoff. I don't know if that's quite the exact word to use, as they Russia actually is moving in and has taken over many of the sort of military posts and things in Ukraine. It may not be much of a standoff anymore, but so much of this is shaped by history, by somewhat recent history. So these all four books here who kind of inform, which inform that process, can explain a little bit of the context there. Again, I'm not going to run through the full list right now, but all four of them are at our website, along with some of Catherine's notes on them at will.illinois.edu. Catherine Stoner, political scientist and senior fellow at the Spogli Institute for International Studies at Stanford, joined us by phone from California. Thank you very much. It was nice to talk to you.
Thank you very much.
And Focus was produced by Lindsay Moon, Jason Croft. Our technical director, Ryan Weber, is our intern. I'm Scott Cameron, and this is Focus from Illinois Public Media.